Hello, and welcome to the audio edition of Beastly Business, the first in a series of animal behavior, human-animal bond mysteries, written and read by Myrna Milani. Chapter 6. After one stop at the Hanover College Library to get copies of several of McCarthy's scientific articles, and another at the bookstore to pick up two of his mysteries, Bloodbath in Barcelona and Four Garrotings and a Hanging, so I could learn how to speak to my new partner in his own language, I spent the rest of the day weeding my flower beds. The next morning, I found myself sufficiently giddy about what the day held that I chattered to the pets like a parakeet on amphetamines. "Today, I'm interviewing the lake people," I cheerily told them as I poured granola into a bowl. "Then I'll tell McCarthy everything I learned, and he'll find out who really killed Monica Sonko." Teresa gave me a troubled look, more likely related to the dead mouse Maddie had stored in her food dish for safekeeping than Chandler McCarthy, but I didn't see it that way. I know McCarthy and I might have a few communications problems. I told the old dog as I paused in my mealtime preparations long enough to pick up the dead mouse by the tail and wing it out the front door. But with a little effort, I'm sure I'll be able to surmount those. I smiled reassuringly at Teresa and gave a quick pat to the now very confused cat staring at the empty dog dish cum safety deposit box. Plus, it's not as if we'll have to work together very long. I then attempted to negate my worst fear to Elizabeth when she stopped grazing the kitchen floor long enough to look at me. With his connections, I'm sure that once I get the information from the lake people, he'll find Monica's killer in no time. Both dogs and the cat sighed heavily. If I had had any sense, I would have sighed too. When I opened the Saab's trunk to unload my gardening tools later that morning, I immediately saw the plastic bag containing the bloodstained rug I'd thrown in there 2 days earlier. As soon as I examined Eleanor's handiwork again, I knew it would require something much more heroic than the cold water soak I'd planned to use to clean it. After stuffing the rug back into the bag, I carried it down to the basement, dropped it on the floor by the washer, and surveyed the shelf filled with laundry aids, seeking the heavy-duty stain remover. Naturally, I didn't find it, because I'd used it up one memorable afternoon, during which my beloved killer cat threw up still recognizable weasel parts all over a visiting Bible thumper determined to save my soul. Following that particularly tactless feline display, my guest made it quite clear that she was never coming back, and that I could rot in hell for all she cared, so the day wasn't a complete loss. Should I drive to town to get more stain remover and clean the rug, or transplant Eleanor's Artemisia and interview the lake residents about Monica and Harley? I asked the cat, for whom I'd squandered my soul. He assumed a very intelligent look when he spied a spider moving along the wall, which I decided meant, go to the lake. Once at the lake, I quickly divided and replanted Eleanor's Artemisia and did some superficial weeding and cultivating to tidy up the flower beds. Having fulfilled my promise to Joe and then some, I set out on the narrow shore path toward the Newcombs' cottage. As I approached the raised lavender and blue dwelling badly in need of a new coat of paint, I could see a young man about Monica's age sitting on one side of a battered dock, staring at the murky water. I introduced myself, then added, gesturing toward Joe's cottage through the trees to emphasize my point, "I'm interested in human-animal interaction, and wondered if you could tell me anything about Monica Sonko and her dog." Douglas DeWitt. He tentatively volunteered his own name as he nervously picked at the moss fringing the rotting boards on the dock. "I don't know anything about her and her dog. They seem pretty normal to me. She played ball with him. They went for walks." "Did the dog ever threaten you?" "Never." He spoke with sufficiently belligerent certainty that it belied his previous statement that he knew nothing about the dead woman and her pit bull. "I take it you did know her and the dog?" I suggested gently. Some of his defenses gave way, and he nodded his head slowly. "We worked together," he reluctantly admitted, staring down at the shallow water as what little confidence he projected rapidly ebbed. At one time I thought we... His words trailed off and he studied his bare feet, leaving me with the distinct impression that, even if Douglas DeWitt didn't particularly want to talk to me about Monica Sonko, he did want to talk to someone. I tried a different approach in an effort to determine if he had been the new man in my now very dead client's life. Did Monica and Harley plan to meet you here? I deliberately included the dog to legitimize the question. DeWitt dug up a considerable pile of mud in the shallow water with his right foot before barely nodding his head from side to side. We both took the same time off, but she had made her plans weeks ago. I came up on the spur of the moment to talk to her about some stuff going on at work. I wanted to ask him what that stuff was, but could think of no appropriate way to broach the subject under the circumstances. Instead, I changed tactics completely, rather than further arouse the suspicions of the already very suspicious young man. You know any of the other dogs around here? I observed the ranks of miniature milky brown waves the wind propelled across the surface of the lake, rather than look at him. As far as I know, there's only two. He volunteered tentatively. A Doberman and a Golden. You know who owns them? This time I did turn toward him when I posed the question. From the troubled look that momentarily flitted across his face, I knew he did, but had no intention of telling me. They both run loose, he explained much too casually given his obvious distress. The Dobie seems kind of high-strung, and I think the Golden comes from somewhere at the north end of the lake. Considering the Winthrop's land encompassed much of the north end of the lake, this was a valuable piece of information I doubted Douglas DeWitt meant to give to me. You know how I can get to the Putnam's Cottage, Putter Inn, from here? That question earned me such a sharp look from DeWitt, I knew that name rang a bell, too. Can't say I ever heard of it. He at least had the decency to redden slightly when he uttered that blatant lie. No problem, I assured him with mock cheerfulness. I'm sure I'll find it. I easily located the Putnam's cottage and its residents. A man about my own age, he stood on the shore, throwing sticks into the turbid water, and a glossy black and red Doberman who observed this process with only slightly veiled apprehension. As I approached, the dog growled and shifted her way to her haunches, a display I didn't consider a good sign at all. The man turned, noticed me, and placed a restraining hand on the animal's collar. Once again I introduced myself, and he extended his free hand in greeting. Jeff Weintraub, he identified himself. He was a small man whose carriage made him appear much larger, and he clasped my hand in a firm grip that lasted just long enough to make me feel uncomfortable. And this is Sabrina. He proudly introduced the dog standing so rigidly at his side, her muscles trembled from the strain. She gets a little uptight around strangers. Noticing the bandage wrapped around his right hand, I suppressed the urge to ask if Sabrina did anything besides tremble when she got uptight, in favor of bringing up the subject of Monica Sonko and Harley. "Say, that was a hell of a thing, wasn't it?" he exclaimed, shaking his head. "I guess it's always in the back of your mind when you own one of the hard-mouthed breeds, but still. People just don't realize how important it is to properly train a dog bred to clamp on like that." He looked from his trembling, hard-mouthed dog to me, as if for confirmation of his own animal's well-trained status. I falsely provided it while the Doberman eyed me distrustfully. "Did you know the woman and her dog?" I then asked. "Not at all. I rented the place for a month so I could get away from people during my vacation." He gave me a broad smile that made me realize he probably was as attractive as he thought he was. "Don't know or want to know anyone on the lake. What about you?" "I like my privacy, too," I smiled politely. "If things work out, I might even be here longer." He gave me a look I told myself couldn't possibly mean what I thought it did. "Maybe you and me should get private together sometime." "Sounds like an oxymoron to me," I quipped, feeling slightly panicky when his eyes swept over my body like a feral dog checking out a rabbit carcass. Weintraub laughed far too heartily at my dumb joke, but his laughter relaxed the Doberman. Her trembling subsided and she leaned slightly toward me. As soon as she did, He instantly grasped her collar, and fear momentarily clouded his previously cheerful features. However, when she made no bad moves, he relaxed his grip and looked at me inquisitively. I nodded, and he released her. Sabrina cautiously approached and tentatively sniffed the hand I offered, palm down with fingers safely curled. She struck me as far more frightened than aggressive, but a bite from either kind of animal could do the same amount of damage. Besides, maybe I can't read dogs as well as I thought, I told myself as I tried not to think about what kind of wound Weintraub's bandage covered. Maybe, like Harley, Sabrina has her little quirks, too. When it became apparent that Jeff Weintraub cared too much about my personal life and couldn't or wouldn't volunteer any useful information about Monica and Harley, I continued my trek along the shore toward the Winthrop's summer home. As I did, I became aware of two characteristics of Somersetshire Lake geography that previously had escaped my notice. One was the dense woodland that served as a natural barrier between Monica's, DeWitt's, and the Weintraub cottages, and all of the other residences on the lake except Journey's End. The second was that those four abodes lay well within easy walking distance of each other using the shore path. Had I walked or even driven the poorly maintained dirt road that wound erratically through the hills surrounding the lake, it would have taken me much longer to make my calls. For sure, a person could easily move between the three cottages and Journey's End without attracting the notice of anyone in the other lake residences or traveling on the road above. Then I turned my attention toward Journey's End. Unlike the other summer homes on Somerset Lake, Journey's End loomed large and formidable. With its peak gables at either end, two symmetrically placed picture windows, and pelt of shaggy brown-stained cedar shakes, it looked like a bored yak staring vacantly at the muddy lake. As I drew closer, I could see a couple standing in the driveway that curved around the side of the house and disappeared up the hill toward the road above. Although the breeze carried their words away from me, the pained expression on the gangly, dark-haired man's face strongly suggested that what the statuesque blonde with the wildly flapping hands yelled at him didn't please him. Nerdo and Ms. Nerdo, I bet. I stood in the trees observing this scene until the woman began pounding on the hood of one of the two Mercedes-Benzes parked in the driveway and convinced me that it was time to go. But before I could make good on my plan to quietly slink away and return some other time, a golden retriever appeared out of nowhere, shot through the air, knocked me flat, and pinned me to the ground. While he grinned down at me, the idea that aliens had taken over the mind of the Somerset Lake canine population vividly occurred to me. "Jason, let her up, bad, oh, you bad, here, boy, come on, here, stop that." And other conflicting commands given in a tone that alternated between fake firmness and downright wishy-washy filled the air. When I noticed a large dollop of drool collecting at the tip of the dog tongue dangling over my face, I decided I couldn't wait for Nerdo Winthrop to assert his authority any longer. But before I could politely suggest that he stop babbling and pull the golden oaf off me, a very authoritative, "Jason, come!" rang out. The dog immediately trotted to Ms. Nerdo and sat obediently. "I'm so sorry," the woman apologized as she helped me to my feet. "Jason's such a lummox sometimes, and Hal lets him get away with murder." Naturally, that particular cliché captured my attention, and I turned toward the individual accused of condoning such atrocious canine behavior. He, in turn, gawked at me through dark-rimmed designer glasses like a baby owl, startled out of a sound sleep. As he seemed content to stare at me forever, I introduced myself and stated my mission to break the spell. "Upton?" He screwed up his chiseled features, perhaps to pump more nutrients to a brain local lore maintained didn't possess Olympic potential. "You're Bob Brown's wife, aren't you?" "His widow," I corrected him, still finding the noun awkward to articulate casually. "What?" He gave me the gaping owl routine again. "I'm his widow," I repeated slowly. "Bob died over a year ago." "Dead?" He gawked at me so intensely I cringed. "For God's sake, Hal, what the hell do you think a person who died is?" the blonde shot out sarcastically. Although I probably would have worded it more tactfully, I had to admit Ms. Nerdo captured the essence of my own sentiments rather well. Pamela, I'm only trying to get the facts here," he responded with exaggerated patience. "Your dog did attack her, you know." "My dog didn't attack her." Ms. Pamela Nerdo Hallard Winthrop Jr. heatedly refuted the accusation as the dog casually got up and ambled in my direction. "Even if he did, what's that got to do with her husband being dead?" "My dog didn't attack her, Pamela. Didn't. Not dent, sweetheart." Hal Winthrop gently corrected his wife as he patted the dog, who had paused long enough to lean against him. By now I was convinced that the dog-brain-sucking aliens had sucked out a few Somerset Lake human brains as well, and I would have left had any polite way of doing so occurred to me. "You must sit down and have a drink," Pamela Winthrop suddenly announced as if the exchange with her husband hadn't occurred. She gestured toward a trio of chic but horrendously uncomfortable wrought-iron chairs, arranged around a matching table filled with bottles, glasses, and an ice bucket. "I'd love to hear your views about what happened to poor Monica." "You knew her?" I instantly assumed my most neutral professional expression. "She worked for Hal." Pamela shot her husband an incomprehensible look as she picked up a bottle of white wine. "No," he contradicted her. "She worked for Dad." "What kind of work does your father do?" I asked in hopes of heading off another spousal confrontation. "He owns a company called TransGen." My host puffed up like a chilled canary when he spoke of his sire's holdings. "We're very small, but doing some fantastic things." "How fascinating." I gushed at this vague revelation and pushed for more information. "What kinds of things?" "Most of it's classified." His tone reminded me of a little kid bragging about his secret clubhouse. "Oh, for crying out loud, Hal, she's a vet, not a damn industrial spy." Pamela yelled at her husband as she turned to me with a brilliant smile and a glass of wine. "Besides, I bet she's already guessed from the name what the company does." "TransGen, TransGen, TransGene, fantastic things." My mind raced through the probabilities at breakneck speed as I sipped my wine and Pamela Winthrop beamed at me. "Transgenic research," I finished the process out loud. "You do cross-species genetic engineering." Pamela nodded and laughed while petting the golden now nuzzling her hand, but her husband looked truly astounded when I made the proper connection. I would have laughed too, but my free association didn't end when I verbalized that conclusion. In spite of everything I did to stop it, it kept bubbling along. "Transgenic research, transgenic animals, transgenic sheep, cattle, goats, goats, goat. McCarthy's missing goat, a very valuable goat, from Massachusetts. Monica's goat, dead Monica's goat. Son of a bitch. We do some very wonderful things." Hal Winthrop quickly got over his horror and jumped in to tout TransGen's accomplishments before his wife outdid him again. "Gene splicing, possibly some cloning in the not-too-distant future. Amazing stuff." "You really splice human genes into animals?" I donned my most captivated student's expression and gazed at him expectantly. "The only way to go," he beamed at me benevolently. "Expensive as all get out right now. But once we get the techniques down, the sky's the limit." His eyes drifted toward the shore. "That's why Monica's death was such a drag," he sighed. "She was one of our best techs." I momentarily felt torn between pursuing further information about the exact nature of TransGen's work and zeroing in on Monica Sonko again. In the end, fate led me to opt for a combined approach. "What exactly did Monica do?" I asked. Then added when suspicion darkened Hal Winthrop's features. "According to the papers, she was only 22. That seems awfully young to be doing such sophisticated work." "She was one of that Leech Weintraub's goat keepers," exploded Pamela Winthrop, a revelation that caused me to prick up my ears immediately. "Monica wasn't just a goat keeper," her husband reproached her quietly. "Those animals need to be constantly monitored." He turned back to me. "They're very valuable," he stated the obvious sincerely. "This is all so new. We just don't know." "Don't know what?" I mentally kicked myself for allowing the inquiry to slip out so quickly. He gave me the industrial spy look again, which once again compelled his wife to speak. How all their screwing around will affect the animals or the proteins they produce. Pamela explained as she pointed to a space beside her, to which Jason obediently trotted and lay down. For as precise as all the DNA replicating and matching techniques are, transgenic splicing is still a pretty crude science. I assume you're trying to produce marketable human proteins for medical use? I asked. Hal nodded sagely. We're specifically looking at the ones that play a role in heart disease. Tremendous profit potential there, what with the population getting older. How's it coming? I pursued the topic casually. My host rubbed the back of his scrawny neck and shot a warning glance in his lovely wife's direction. Pretty good. Had a major setback recently. He measured his words carefully. But that's to be expected in this line of work. You mean Monica's death? I asked the question thinking it irrelevant, but also because I realized that anything might lead the erratic Winthrops to give me more information. Hal Winthrop pondered that while Pamela stared into space like a dutiful corporate wife awaiting her husband's words of wisdom. It looked like it was killing her. Yes and no, he finally volunteered after what appeared to be a monumental thought process. We can replace her, but the project she was working on, well, some things have happened. That minor disclosure appeared to distress him so much, I directed the conversation away from Monica's work, lest I raise his suspicions again. I'm only interested in what caused Monica's dog to attack her. I let the floundering man off the hook. Did you see much of her and the animal? I'd occasionally see her playing with him on the beach. Pamela pointed to a break in a cluster of birches that framed a view of Joe's cottage. Other than that, I don't think she ever came here. She turned back to her husband. Did she, Hal? I detected an edge in Pamela Winthrop's voice that hinted at something more than idle curiosity. Why would she? He replied with that same trace of patronizing patience I'd noticed before. I heard she came up here to get away. Probably some romance went sour on her. Pamela Winthrop shot her husband a look that clearly indicated she didn't believe him. On the other hand, I did. I knew that at least the romance between Harley and Monica Sonko had gone sour. But did it go sour enough for Harley to kill her? Or did some, more socially acceptable romantic interest, brutally murder her when he discovered that his closest competition was a dog? You've been listening to an excerpt from Beastly Business, an animal behavior and human-animal bond mystery written by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries, books on animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavioral and bond sites, check out my website at mm@mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the book Beastly Business in any form are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music in The Steppes of Central Asia by Alexander Bordin is used with permission of Katova Arts, www.katova.com.